Start with introductions of staff or?
Well, first of all, I was hoping that being February that we might get an instant quorum. But make sure if you talk to others, and we will by email as well, we have everyone captured by email to correspond, that once the Baywide winter dredge survey results are in, which we kind of hope later in April, we try and have a meeting with the Crab Management Advisory Committee pretty shortly thereafter.
Right.
And that'll be the same. And so realistically, after tonight, we're going to have to defer, if there's not a quorum, you know, taking motions and going through all that part of it. Mm-hmm. When we look at the timing, if the committee meets in April, late April, I'm expecting, if it's like other years, it'll be a May commission meeting to take action. Now, that does not stop the commission from having emergency measures. Okay, so that will not be a problem that way. It's not like it's the first time that they've had to do something like that. So as we go through these items, please keep that in mind. You know, no one's going to be shut out just by the timing of the meetings. We'll do the best we can to have information in April for May. And, you know, really, it's nice to finalize everything in May, but we've done it in June before.
Right.
Possibility to do it in June, because what we're on now is a July 5th to July 4th season.
Okay.
So,
but tell us again the season. Would you
mind? July 5th of 1 year to July 4th of the next year.
Okay.
And that's been since 2014.
Okay.
And I think it might be a good idea. Even though everyone is not here on the committee, you're going to have some new faces on our staff here. Mm-hmm. And I think it'd be really nice if they could just go around and get themselves to everyone, including running back to Virginia Institute of Marine Science. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that'll help when they get up to make presentations. You won't wonder who they are.
Okay.
So, Alex, you lead off.
My name is Alex Aspinwall, and I'm a data analyst here.
My name is Jill Ramsey. I've been with DMRC for 3 years now. I'm currently the quota monitoring.
So Jill has seniority with about 2.5 years right now. In August, I'll hit 31. And you know, Ron,
I already hit 30.
You got a few years.
I'm like a day over 30. Right. And then, Gabby, you want to introduce yourself?
Okay. We've got our stenographer.
Anna Mai Christmas Didlinga, and I am a data specialist here and currently taking the minutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And board, you want to go through our board as well?
I think it'd be nice to know everyone.
Don, you want to start us off?
I'm Don Porter, grabber.
And tell them where you're from.
Sykes's.
Okay.
Wayne Morris. I'm from Warsaw, Virginia. Just crab fisherman.
Ed Tankard, Exmoor, Virginia nurseryman on the commission.
J.C. Hudgens, a waterman, Matthews, Virginia, and also president of the Virginia Watermen's Association.
I'm Mark Sanford. I live in Chatham, Virginia, which is on the eastern shore, and I crab in Lynnhaven in the lower bay.
I'm Peter Nixon. I'm a crabber. I'm from Norfolk.
Okay. Very good.
Okay. Excellent, sir.
So I won't spend a lot of time on this summary information. You've seen a lot of it before. Some of it is you know very well. And I'm just going to go through this, and we'll just move through it. But I think the main information on this first slide, you know. that since 2008, the crab pot is pretty much the predominant gear type, you know, 95-96% of the harvest. If we go back to 2008, the 4% here is mainly, well, that was the last few months of the dredge season, if you remember that. So that's why it's not 95 or 96% crab pot. The other thing, and I haven't done that, but I've done it in the past, and you're aware of that, and I was thinking roughly if you multiply the pounds by 2.5 for the peeler, you get an idea of how many peelers. So I used to use some static multipliers, and the numbers of crabs were presented to you. There always used to be quite a, you know, if you're a peeler crabber, you would say, well, listen, we're only 4 or 5%. But in numbers, when we had the healthy years and the healthy fishery, you know, it's more like 9%, 8%, something like that, peeler crab. Pete?
How do you come up with a pound number on peelers? All of us that report give you numbers of peelers.
Right.
I mean, do you...
There's conversions in the database. You can tell me whether what I use as a static conversion is about 0.21-something pounds per peeler. So, you know, not quite 5 in a pound. I think if you talk to the people in the dredge survey, especially the Maryland folks, they sort of have different sliding sizes as they go through, and they really didn't like what I did in the past because it wasn't perfect. So, so that's that part. This is just sort of taking a look at the harvest, the pounds in millions here, versus the number of trips, which is the best effort data we have. We do not have accurate pot counts. I think you know that most folks, if they report their pots, they report whatever they're allowed to have, and they don't change it even if they change the number of pots or even if the pots they fish are more than their allocated amount. So we've been through that before. I think what you see here is there is a relationship in orange, the effort, the trips, and the harvest up to a certain point. It falls down a little bit here. You know, probably get some kind of correlation out of there. But, you know, again, this is our only effort index, and that's why I wanted to present it.
Mm-hmm.
This can make your eyes cross a little bit, but what this is doing is taking the effort in orange and the catch per unit effort in blue. And, you know, hard to say. I don't think that was statistically significant when we looked at it, that relationship. But it tells you there are times where you've got higher CPUE, pounds per harvester, or pounds even for a trip, at times when you had a lower amount of effort. So there's not really a tight relationship there. Any of this information could be worked on for a while. The sad situation in Virginia is that we don't have someone dedicated to blue crab more than a few months. For a few months each year, we do our best to piece together what we have, and with a minimal $30 million dockside value, it's my hope someday that we have someone who can work full-time pretty much on crabs. I think that's what we need. I know oysters are important. Oysters get a lot of play, especially since about 2010. But blue crab is a very important resource, and I don't think we do a very good job of monitoring that resource. This year was the first time, or this past year, I should say, where at one time we had two sort of contractual personnel out doing sampling, and then it fell down to one person. Well, that's a lot compared to what we've done in the past. We hadn't even done that in the past. So if you get a chance to put in a good word, put it in for blue crab, because I think that's, you know, something that is in need of some monitoring and good help. This just shows the crab pot harvest relationships here, number of harvesters, number of trips, and the corresponding pounds. And you can look at this a little bit. So we'll look at last year. certainly the fewest harvesters, and not the fewest trips, but a low amount of trips compared to some of the other earlier years, yet the harvest was 22 million pounds.
Mm-hmm.
You can also look up here at 2009, and if you look here, 2008 is when that 34% reduction in female harvest baywide occurred. Measures that you helped go through, and many of you probably wish that some of those hadn't been done, but nonetheless, all jurisdictions did it. These years were pretty good from 2009 to 11, and they kept on increasing for us. Maryland, the way I remember it, had a huge jump from 2009 to 2010. We didn't have that kind of jump. And then you see, if you remember 2012, it was a terrific March. I mean, March was about almost 2.5 million pounds from the 17th to the 31st of March. And then the rest of the year started to slide. And I think it's important to think about our harvest in relation to spring and fall. And, you know, I'll have some information later on that, because I know the price in the spring is what you really want. We know that. And other states aren't becoming that active. So it is a big deal that way.
Rob?
Yes.
So there's 791 licensed hard crab potters that are reporting catch?
Yes. Yeah. They have at least been there at some point.
Okay.
If you really wanted to look at this data correctly, you would just be looking at individuals who had, let's say, they were out there 1 to 5 trips, 6 to 10, all the way up to as many trips as they take. Some take a lot of trips.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be the best way to really look at this.
Mm-hmm.
So for here, it is a nominal amount of effort. If they were out there, they get counted.
But it doesn't mean peel a potter.
No, not yet.
Okay.
Do you have that broken down at all, anywhere? You know, say how many people make more than 100 trips?
We haven't lately. We did in the past. We did do that in the past. We had, matter of fact, when, trying to think back of when it was, when we were going through the process with your committee, and we were meeting at BIMS a couple of times, and then meeting here, and we were trying to determine the waiting list. So this is all leading into about 2008, who was on the waiting list and everything else. We did look at sort of trips that were in increments, and who fill those trips. We haven't
trips
done
and
that
license either. Classes.
Pardon?
Trips and license classes, what mm-hmm. I remember.
Yes, yes. So we have been through that. We're doing a little less. I mean, we'll accelerate as we can by the time of the commission to really look at the data, but this is really us just getting started. And we have Sarah doing some of this work. Alex does some of this work. So we're just kind of getting geared up. This is one of the old standbys that is done differently here. And there is something interesting about this information. If you look, the blue squared areas are where they have the highest harvest, the months with the highest harvest. Now, we've always known that that jumps around. And, yes, it does jump around. I mean, June barely is the highest harvest in 2012, July in 2008, and also in 2013 and 14. And then the orange is the secondary important month. But what I saw today that's really interesting, if you look at these 3, 4, 5 best type of months, 18 to 23% of the total harvest is realized in the spring through April. I mean, just through April. If you look at where the top months in 2012 through 2015 were not as strong, except for 2012, the other months in 2013, 14, and 15 through April are only accounting for 4 to 6% of the total harvest. So what that means to me, and I'll show you a slide later, When we look at 2009, 10, and 11, the female spawning age crabs from the winter dredge survey were very good those 3 years. And in fact, in 2016 and 17, they were very good again. And conversely, when you look at 2013, 14, and 15, the spawning age female crabs were very poor. So it should tell you that what we see with the dredge survey, the spawning age females are going to determine our spring harvest pretty much. I mean, I haven't taken this back, and Sarah hasn't taken this back through the whole time series, you know, all the way back to 1990. I don't think there's any reason to, but I think that that's pretty important. The second part of this I didn't go through today. We have tried to do in the past. You know that the juveniles that VIMS and Maryland DNR have in their winter dredge survey are in the fishery by late August and fall. So you could do the same thing with the juveniles to see at least, is there more or less a correspondence of having high juveniles and having a pretty good late summer or fall harvest. So we'll do that for next time around, but at least it puts this information in context in relationship to the winter dredge survey, which now has about 29 years, I think, and, you know, is an important part of how you make decisions and how the commission makes decisions. This is the change that happened last year because of the fourth lowest amount of juveniles. What the commission did was that they extended the time in November when there was a lower bushel limit. You know, and you can go down here from 8 to 27 depending on your pot category. Previously, that had started 11-16. And so the commission came in as one of the measures last year and put the reduced bushel limit in this time period. And I think when you see the winter dredge survey data and you see what the juveniles look like, that that's the time to say, well, you know, fourth lowest last year, they might be the sixth or seventh highest this year. Who knows? I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying that. But that should help to figure out how you adjust the bushel limits, because many of you said, we like the bushel limits, but also those bushel limits are supposed to be able to be increased as well as decreased. And I think that's fair to say that. This is just information on what we have for the maximum pots by gear license. So all this is Sarah, and probably had a little help from Adam Kenyon, I'm not sure, went ahead and looked at all the categories we have and looked at the amount of pots that they could have under their license. And then when you go through the different categories, you can see that there was a lot more effort, at least according to who was in the fishery back in earlier years, back heading into the 2000, up to about 2004 maybe. And then it's been pretty stable. But again, this is just a situation where we don't really know, just because they have a certain amount of pots per category, that that's what they're fishing. That was what prompted the start of the bushel limits and the vessel limit, because we knew that we're definitely fighting a losing battle to figure that out. And law enforcement, as you know, has made a few cases of over the limit, but I think the last one I heard, it took three officers all the way from the morning into dusk, and they had to stop, but by then there was over the limit anyway. So it's not an easy thing to do to deal with the pots, so that's why the bushel limits and the vessel limits emerged. This shows you the relationship from the maximum by license that you saw earlier by month. And you can see that what you would expect, you know, really May through September, pretty similar. The orange line is what comes out of our database. So those are the reports. Sarah, did you want to add anything on that? That seem okay? All right. So, again, not sure where we'll go with this because we get these questions about how many pots are out there. And, you know, my idea to find out how many pots are out there is to look at each individual crabber and at least assign the maximum he's allowed, which we've done now, but is that really answering the question? Because I think the number of pots is less than, I was kind of surprised, I think the number of pots is less than 300,000, 200 and
200, yeah.
Something, wasn't it? Okay. All right. Will we see that here or not? This gives you an idea of the areas. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You just showed it on the last scale, 200 and some thousand.
Okay, good. So you're paying attention.
Yep. I've done some in mine. Figures are pretty close.
Do you think there's much underreporting of number of pot fished?
I think it happens just because it's not the best thing that a harvester feels he has to report. I think a harvester feels like the pounds is, or the numbers of crabs is number one. And, you know, we went out with mandatory reporting to have an aside here for a second. We went out with mandatory reporting before we started it. And we went all over the place and talked to everyone, explained it, and did all that. After that, which, you know, ended in about 1993, it's all phone calls. So you're talking to the harvester by phone trying to explain things. Well, last year, there was a little bit of money, enough money to go out and meet with harvesters and go through problems that they're having with mandatory reporting, bring them up to date. And I thought we had a taker from the Eastern Shore, but at the last minute, they said, nope, don't worry about it. So we have to continue to have these dialogues, remote dialogues instead of in-person dialogues. Mm-hmm. And we've also moved to electronic reporting, where I'm going to guess there might be about 300 with all we do electronic reporting going on. And so, I mean, if we jump forward 5 years, it's going to be entirely different. Be entirely different. So, this just shows you a little bit by system. And as you would expect, you know, the main stem of the bay, doesn't matter what month it is, that's the predominant harvest area. You know, these are the Potomac tribs, actually, in blue. So quite a bit going on in the late summer. And then if you want to look at one other area, perhaps the James, pretty steady throughout, a little bump up in summer. They all tail off in the fall. So what I remember is you might have 550 harvesters out there in October. By November, you probably have 250, 260. Baywide. This you've seen before, I know, won't spend a lot of time on it, but for those who aren't used to it, in the orange line, we're seeing who's eligible. And since 2004, you can be eligible without buying your license. You maintain your eligibility, so that's gone on since 2004. The only glitch in that was creation of the waiting list, which the commission came in 2008 and said, if you haven't harvested 2004 to 7, I believe it was, you're going to be on a waiting list. But more or less, you have not had to buy your license. In the blue, it's the individuals who have purchased the license. And I don't want to think about why this occurs, but when you look at the active is down here. So there are individuals, a couple of hundred, who are buying the license. They're not using their eligibility. Maybe they're concerned if they don't buy the license. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of, that they'll be left out. But the active is certainly much less. This starts the peeler pot harvest. And you can see that this has a pretty good relationship between pounds harvested and number of trips. I mean, when the trips are up, up go the pounds in blue, and I think this was a significant relationship, actually, I think, it, from what I recall. And then as things go down, so does the harvest. And, you know, 2004 probably was where things started to go down after 2004. But you can see there were some pretty high harvests back in the 2000s. I mean, that peeler fishery ramped up starting in the late 90s up until the mid-2000s. This looks a little bit, again, at effort, which is in orange, and the catch per unit effort, and not much to say there. It doesn't seem to be what anyone would hang their hat on for having some kind of a correlation. You know, it's pretty, this is almost without, you know, just a little bit of noise, and this is very variable on the effort. So, you know, maybe someone can look into that and refine it for you next time. I don't know. The peeler pot data, so the harvesters, as you go down the years, they're fairly similar. They've dropped off a little bit in the last couple of years, and certainly not as many in 2009. But keep in mind that 2009 was when we got a nice pulse of abundance of crabs, and you got a lot of information in there as far as the effort went. The harvest is nothing like it was after before 2004, leading up to the late 90s. I mean, it's really not dissimilar. The outlier is 2013, but 2013 was a poor year all around. And so this fluctuates a little bit. It doesn't seem to be more than just the abundance that comes out and the ability to hit that time when, you know, you can do your peeler crabbing and you don't have other problems weather-related getting away. This is even more interesting in that the eligibility, and in the last graph I should point out too, in case you're wondering what happened with this big drop. So this was that buyout that was part of the crab disaster relief. And yes, there were individuals who sold out and sold the license. And because of that, you see this drop down to 2009. But even after the drop, the eligibility remains the same. Harvesters are buying the license, but much less, you know, 250 less harvesters actually by number are working out there compared to buying the license. Okay, so we'll stop there. any other questions?
Any questions from?
I got one.
Go ahead.
The for the, I guess the active crabbers or peeler potters that have the license and they're active, or I'm sorry, not active, but they have the license. They're not using it. How many are selling them and then becoming active crabbers?
I don't know. I mean, a few years ago, I tried.
I've seen a downward trend in activity.
I don't think
that's
it's
obvious.
As busy as it has been in the past because your committee brought things down, but there's still 125 agents, which is for another topic, I hope. But, you know, that seems to shorten the amount or lessen the amount of transfers, but I'd be happy. You know, we've got it in
the database.
I'm
just kind of curious to see if there's a trend, you
know.
We
can tell you.
People, you
know,
we
can tell you.
Okay.
Sure.
It's plenty of people getting out of the business, I tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely our trend.
Yeah.
It's not good. Not for the watermen, anyway.
No.
No. And it's, you know, it's just getting tough. I mean,
everything's
gone up. You know, and you know, we're still stuck with 8-bushel limit, 10-bushel limit. I mean, you can't make it on that anymore. That's something we got to work on. Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why we need a June commission meeting rather than a May commission meeting to give time to get some more members here too and work at that, because we really should be fair about the bushel limits and use it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay, the next slide is just the what you've heard.
Mr. Chairman, can I make a...
Sure.
One thing that you need to think about on these bushel limits, to go along with what JC was talking about, it's different from one end of the bay to the next. And it's different from one end of the bay to the next different times of the season. You just put a bushel limit out there, total crab bushel limit. Something I think we might think about looking at is bushel limits for males and bushel limits for females. There is no way that I'll ever catch a bushel limit of males anymore. And I don't know what this should be, but I think it ought to be looked at anyway.
I think at last year's commission meeting to make these decisions, I know Wayne France and I think at the time A.J. Erskine were saying pretty much that we're not getting the amount of male crabs. We're getting fewer male crabs in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And we looked at that data and came back, and the percentages actually went up the last couple of years. But on your question, I think what
see, that's my point. It might be different, you know, where J.C. crabs and where I crab. Mm-hmm. And we used to have terrific male crab fishing, and it's just almost non-existent now.
What you could do, I don't know how it would look, but what you could do would be to, we have essentially 9 systems that we use, so the James River is a system mm-hmm. in its entirety to start out with. York, the Rappahannock, Chesapeake Bay, we've got the Seaside, we've got 9 systems. You could look at harvesters from those areas and see what they had harvested, find ones that have done 3 years in a row, 2 years in a row maybe if we're lucky, and see what they're realizing. And that might give some insight as to how you would do what you're asking. That's something that we probably can look at. We've got a couple people, well, one person that uses SAS. Other people have other ways of looking at this. If I did it, I'd be doing this until next Christmas. So we'll get some people with some high-powered.
Just a suggestion.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Good suggestion. As we lead into the winter dredge survey results coming up, which I think is the 29th year or season. The question always has been to you, what do you think should be your response to the number of spawning age female crabs and the number of juveniles? And I think inadvertently, I have been thinking today that maybe what we just talked about a little while ago is one of the responses that, you know, first of all, it may be an opportunity to adjust bushel limits if there's favorable abundance. The second thing is to look at the spring and the fall and to sort of figure out should there be changes there. I mean, right now, the way the bushel limits are, you have a smaller amount in November and a smaller amount in March. And the reason is to make sure that the crabs that were juveniles come back through the end of the year and aren't hammered in the spring. But other than March and November, there may be a way to adjust bushel limits based on the survey as well. And I know that Dr. Lipschitz back there probably would be a big asset in helping figure that out. So that's one thought for you.
We always get the numbers so late.
You get them in April. But you're planning for July to the next July.
Right.
So.
And March is a bad month.
The numbers that you showed earlier reflect what the dredge survey showed for March and April and what the harvest reflected in that. Well, we don't get those numbers till May.
Right.
You know, but it shows that according to the dredge survey, your harvest prediction was correct as an afterthought.
Right. It is an afterthought. Mm-hmm. So again, with this July to July, let's just suppose the winter dredge survey, Baywide winter dredge survey, comes back and says, last year was terrible on juveniles, but it comes back and says there's above average or even higher amount of juveniles. So that could be a way for you to say, Okay, well, if that's the case, maybe we change our bushel limits in the early fall, late summer, early fall. I'm just throwing this out to you.
Right.
The spawning age females, you're going to see them, as Pete said, they're going to happen already. They're getting ready to happen March 17th.
Right.
But they still carry on. I mean, you still have the summer, and when we looked at that data, the summer months are when everyone is out there, and from all I've ever heard, not making the money they would like to make. So, you know, that's something the committee can talk about as well. I mean, the ideal situation is to, it's been a few years, you know, Pete's been with the committee for as long as I remember. There was a time where the committee was so active that it helped the management. And so, do we get back to that? I don't know. How do we do that? So,
you know,
but it'd be good if the committee could be that active, because you're the ones involved with the resource closely. And, you know, I'm hoping that at least this year you have a chance to say, well, we've looked at the data from the Winter Dredge Survey, and we think here's how we should have our bushel limits. It's going to take a little effort to do this, because we've all been, since 2014, we've been static pretty much on the bushel limits. So, so I'll offer that up to you. And
well, one key to this is going to be getting some people to show up.
Yeah, yeah. And we periodically.
You know, we used to have, you know, Johnny Graham and Kevin Wade and all the crabbers and everybody here too. We had a problem the last Finfish committee. I filled in for Scott McDonald and Chris. No, I filled in for Skipper Garrett. We almost didn't have a quorum that night. And then Meade got up and left in the middle of the thing. And this is a problem.
Yep.
I'm going to talk to the new commissioner about this.
All the committees except for Shellfish. Shellfish Management Committee always has a quorum. Matter of fact, they always have great attendance.
Yeah.
I blame it on all sorts of things, but I think the electronic age is what I blame it on. It's not just here. It's in the other states. You know, it's the same things going on, but I agree with you. We do go through the list, the attendance list, and it takes a little while, but we try and look to see how many meetings someone's missed, and we have made replacements, but we haven't done that recently here. So,
yeah.
A really good point.
I think, Rob, I think my interpretation of why shellfish works and crab doesn't, I think, because I think the shellfish, we're getting things accomplished. We're getting some changes. We're getting some positive changes for the watermen, for the industry itself, and we're not seeing it in CMAC yet in the on the crab side of it, and that's why I think our numbers of crabbers are going down all the time. You know, why the oyster is holding steady. Got a good resource there. We got a good crab resource, but we got to make it so people can make a living at it.
Okay, that's a good perspective. Very good perspective. So I think we're scheduled to start talking about the sanctuary areas. We have done that before, and the regulation is here. That gives you an idea of the different areas. If you remember, a couple of years ago, it became effective. I think in 2016, the dates changed. And, you know, you have a June 1 start up here. You've got a May 16th start of the closure, I should say, all the way till September 15th. This closes May 16th to September 15th. Here we get into the May 9th. And so, what I recall, and, you know, again, Rahm's going to help us out with this, but what I recall is that there was some interest in two parts of the sanctuary proposal. One was to change the dates, you know, make areas 2 through 4 the same as area 1B here. Bring it back to May the 16th. As when the closure starts to commercial crabbing out to September 15th. And the other area, which I have to say complicated us a little bit, was to get an area here along the coastal area that could have some crabbing effort again. It hasn't had it since 2006, I believe. And there were never that many crabbers there, what I remember. But as part of what happened when we changed the sponge crab times of year, you know, when we fell back, I think we were at July the 15th originally, and we fell back in 2007. Now we're at the end of June, July, you know, July 1st. It's okay to keep the dark-colored sponge crabs. That was sort of a trade-off, is the best way to describe it. And I know that Mr. Sanford has been interested the last couple of years in seeing something happen here. I believe three years ago, time's flying, Mark, but 3 years
really?
Ago, the city of Virginia Beach had a little bit of a problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're back here again. Mr. Sanford has offered it doesn't have to be a big area. The complication for staff was that the area that Mark shows was starting to cut a little bit into Area 3 and even Area 2.
No, it wasn't Area 2.
Just 3.
Just
okay,
3.
Just 2's legislative entirely.
Right.
And I think
aware
we're
aware of that.
Okay. So I'll have to see what we have here. This gives you an idea, a little blown up idea. And those are the two proposals. And when we went to the change of the dates for the sanctuaries, especially the northern part of it, when we went to June 1, Rahm had worked out a fairly conservationally neutral approach that allowed those date changes. Realistically, I think in that northern area, they don't start seeing crabs until later anyway. But Rahm, do you want to kind of pitch in what you think of the two proposals?
So for me,
come on up.
So good evening. So for me, the proposals, I think switching the closure date to the 16th. To me is a very reasonable way to do it. The other one, Mark's not going to like this, but as far as closing things down south or opening them, the problem that I run into in terms of the biology is that most of the crabs that are down there are going to spawn. They're there. That's where they've been heading, so they've reached the area where they're going to be spawning. Whereas the crabs up top, up north, are not. They're still moving down, and they're not quite ready to spawn. So biologically, it would be more reasonable for me to have those three areas opened up, closed later on the 16th, and to try to allow people to harvest in those areas. And I personally, I would not have a problem with that. I think the females in general have been in pretty good shape. We've got some good resilience in that. But trying to open something up far south where the females especially are already typically sponged out and so on, it's going to be more difficult for me biologically. That's the thing.
Hey. Yes, sir.
You said at the last meeting when we discussed this that you didn't particularly have a problem with that.
Well, originally the issue really comes down to the fact that we don't sample there.
That's exactly what
and
you said.
And that's a problem for me, so I can't justify anything really as far as opening it, but I do know that it's primarily mature females that are already ready to spawn out. So it's a qualitative decision, right?
Here's our point, and I crab down there some, not much, 3 or 4 years. It's a risky business because all you have to do is have an offshore swell and all your stuff is either on the beach or it goes into Cape Henry Hole. So I've had them come all the way around the around the corner and be in the pound nets, which is where the little duck head turns down to where it looks like a bill. To travel from that blue area all around the corner, you wouldn't think it'd do it, but they'll do it, and they'll do it overnight.
Would it not suit the needs if you were to open up, if you wouldn't close Area 3, for instance, and the other two?
Well, let me finish.
All right.
What Mark is getting at is there is so much pressure from crabbers inside Lynn Haven and Broad Bay and Linkhorn and all that it would give a place for a couple of crabbers to get out of there. And we've got a situation where the residents are having a fit down there. You've heard about all this oyster legislation and everything. And part of their main concern down there is really not oyster cages, it's crab pots. But they confuse the two because they see it as a wired device and, you know, they just want to get them all out of there. And it would alleviate that problem and actually get crab pots off of what might be a more valuable product at the time, your male crabs and peelers and stuff like that, and, you know, I'm talking about to the resource, and get it out there where some of those crabs, the percentage that we would catch of them would be so low. You know, like I said, you're only going to have two or three people go down there at the most.
So let me ask a question.
But it gets the people out of the inside.
So do we have the ability to know what the landings are from Lynn Haven, separate from other areas?
We have Lynn Haven.
Okay, so if... So what I'm suggesting, you could potentially do something like that. I would recommend doing it with a sunset clause where we would look at what the landings are out of Lynn Haven, and are they, in fact, changing at all? Because if they don't change, it means that we're putting extra pressure on the resource. But if they, in fact, do go down for the crabbers, then that means that there's some compensation going on. So I think I'd want to see something like that so that it's not just added pressure on the resource.
In other words, you might be willing to look at it for one season or something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to do it and let... I think at this point with the stock, I think we can do these sort of trial and error situations with the sunset clause, and you say, okay, let's look at this. What's going on? Is it having any kind of effect whatsoever? Can we detect any effect? And if not, then I think we're good, because it is a minor change. If you look at the whole stock, whoops, you look at the whole stock, it's going to be a minor change. And so I would be totally open to doing a temporary.
That's effort.
Yeah, it's not like.
Yeah, you're talking two or three people. Probably two people would go to the ocean.
No, I totally understand.
Period. And really that effort that's, like last year, I can tell you right now, dependent upon where Lynn Haven closes, the sanctuary, if it's the 9th or the 6th, whatever, the 16th, I'm going to go back to Cape Charles. I'm going to go right back to the concrete ships.
Right.
So my effort is shifting. It's going to go right to Eastern Shore. That basically is the same crab as you catch off the ocean front. It's no different,
right.
Period. Plain and simple. It's the same.
Well, it all depends on the really what's the catch per unit of effort, right? Because at some point... You have so much of a pie, and then all you're doing is splitting
it. Breaking it up, exactly.
Or are you increasing it? So, you know, if the crabbers in Lynn Haven, for instance, if their catch per unit effort goes up.
I don't think you're going to create an increase in effort. Down
no.
There. You might move some effort, but you're not going to.
You're shifting.
You're not
yeah, and the whole equitability. And so.
And all it is about, can I make more money inside and irritate a bunch of residents, or can I do it outside and be left alone? It's a different quality product. It's a pick-in-house product. You everything down there, you cannot retail it.
No.
It's got to go right to the pick-in-house.
Right.
But it's a good pick-in-house product. But it's just a difference in what you choose to do in order to earn a living. And we've had that removed. And it was Rick Robbins' idea to do it. And... I don't know that it's produced anything, really. I mean,
No. You
know, it, like you said, you don't even sample down there. The crabs are all the when they go down there, they're all the way to. I'm going to tell you where they used to be. They used to have the it's a fishing pier now at Sandbridge, It used to be a pumping station where they pumped salt water from the ocean into Back Bay. And the Asian folks, there's a ditch on the other side of Sandbridge Road, right at the almost to the game refuge, and they would chicken neck where the pump outfall was. So you've got females all the way down there and further on down, too. I've hauled seine further on down there all the way to the Carolina line, and we would catch females in our beach seines down there. What little bit we do as far as harm up there, I don't even know if you could measure it.
So I think I'd be pretty comfortable saying the VIMS would support sort of a temporary change like that. Let's assess it. Is it really doing much? With a 1 or 2 year sunset clause, I think we probably need 2 years to really get a handle on it. So we'd be supportive of that.
Well, that's a start.
Yeah.
Right. Anything else?
And Rob did come back. You're right. Rob did come from the committee meeting. Rob came back, and then last time around the commission meeting, he had time to think about it a little bit and express concerns, just like he expressed tonight. But I think if we get a trial, that's good. The date change should be beneficial. Back to May 16th for the closure through September 15th. So we'll look forward to that.
Just to reassure Rom, I've been around here a long time. And the only time that I've ever seen anybody other than two or three local Lynn Haveners go out in the ocean was in the spring back in the very early 70s. We used to have four or five Guineamen would come down to Lynn Haven and crab in the spring. Most of them are all deceased now that would come down there or have retired. And one or two of them would venture out there. Really only one of them, Maynard Jr. Bonneville. And he'd crab all the way to where he used to joke coming in. He didn't know whether he called it yak and pots or whether he was getting surfers' heads. You know, buoys or surfers' heads. But those are the only people that I've ever seen down there before and since.
Hey, right.
Yes.
About the city of Virginia Beach, I talked to quite a few people down there, and none of them seem to have a problem. I wrote their names down. I didn't bring their names. Would they have something to do with the coastal management? I think it's what the office is. And I can't remember the fellow's name I talked to. I actually talked to several of them. They've actually come here for some of your commission meetings about dredging, right. One of the individuals that I talked to.
We're not close to the beach. You can't get up and surf.
Yeah, I mean, you're not.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds good moving forward to me. Mm-hmm. And, Mr. Chairman, I think we're going to talk a little bit about options to address ghost pot problems.
Okay.
So to start off, I'm just going to give everyone some background information. It might be review for most people here, but I thought that would be a good place for you to start off your discussion. So ghost pots or derelict crab pots are pots that have come loose from their anchors or the buoys and drift to the bottom of the bay, and they continue to fish. This graph is from research that has been done at VIMS. VIMS researchers, in collaboration with local watermen from 2009 to 2012, collected more than 32,000 ghost pots from Virginia tidal waters. So it is a substantial problem. Research indicates that between 10 and 30% of crab pots are lost each year. And last year, if every harvester who harvested crabs in Virginia waters put out at some point in the year the maximum number of pots that they are licensed to fish, that would have meant about 230,000 pots that were deployed in Virginia waters. And if 10% of those pots went missing, then that is kind of the effort that the watermen and VIMS put out, collecting those pots, pretty much going back in. The reason this is a problem, as we all know, is because the lost pots continue to catch crabs and fish. And it's becoming very clear to us that this is a growing concern both within the Waterman community and amongst the civilians. So the two solutions that we were hoping to have a discussion about today are the use of biodegradable escape panels, including polyhydroxyl alkanate, a PHA, biodegradable panels, and this is a special plastic panel that we will talk about, some common natural alternatives, and then also the potential use of pot tending requirements as a mitigating kind of factor. So for the biodegradable escape panels, so currently there are 10 Atlantic and Gulf states that have in place regulations for some fishery of theirs to have an escape panel on their pots. Four of those states, New York, New Jersey, Florida, and Texas, have regulations that specifically target crab pots for the blue crab fishery. The regulations in New Jersey and New York require that the panel cover an opening that is 6.5 inches wide by 5 inches high. And the regulations in Florida and Texas require the panel covers an opening 3 by 6 inches, and it can be in either direction. So the PHA biodegradable panels. These panels are made up of a plastic that can be dissolved by enzymes that bacteria that are commonly found in marine waters produce. Now, when these bacteria are exposed to UV light, it inhibits their growth. So actively fished pots will not degrade because the bacteria will not be growing and producing the enzymes. But for a pot that becomes derelict and is no longer near the top of the water, but now on the bottom, not exposed to as much UV light, those bacteria will proliferate, and the panels will degrade. And the panels right now, this is an older prototype, but this is what they look like. And they are designed to function as the coal ring that we currently require all our crab pots and peeler pots to have. Currently, I've been told the cost of each panel is about $1.50 per panel. Now, all of the states that require escape panel or that have escape panel regulations allow for the use of kind of alternate natural materials. For instance, untreated hemp, cotton, or thistle jute twine that is just 3/16 an inch in diameter, or non-stainless steel, uncoated ferrous wire, no greater than 3 32 inches in diameter, or a soft wood lath that's not thicker than 3/8 inch. And this is just a hypothetical rendering of how one might use the wire or the twine in place of the biodegradable panel. So the second option that we wanted to bring to you guys to talk about, or to you to talk about, are potential pot tending requirements. And these requirements were actually brought forth in front of the committee and also in front of the commission in 2011. The issue was tabled and has not been proposed since, but we thought that pot tending might be a potential way to, as I said before, mitigate this issue. If watermen are checking their pots on a regular basis, perhaps the pots are less likely to become derelict. So I'm going to read for you or explain to you the regulatory changes that were initially proposed in 2011. These are not changes that we're necessarily proposing now. We just thought that this would be a good jumping off point for the discussion. So in 2011, the regulation that we were considering writing was, it shall be unlawful for any person to set any commercial crab pot or peeler pot and not tend that pot for more than 5 consecutive days after it has been set. If a marine police officer determines that a pot has not been tended within 5 days, a verbal warning will be issued to the waterman who owns that pot, either by telephone or in person, or the Marine Police officer will place a tag upon that pot, a warning tag, letting the waterman know that the pot has been not tended within the allotted time. And if within 24 hours that pot has not been removed, the Marine Police officer is authorized to confiscate the pot. So these are the two kind of solutions that we have brought for you guys to for you to discuss this evening. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but I leave it to you gentlemen to continue the discussion.
All right. Got questions?
Yeah, can you go back to your first first boards? Let's see. Yeah, you say those states actually require it now.
Yes, they require it. Now, only New Jersey, New York, Florida, and Texas require it for the blue crab fishery. Okay. Like for Maine and New Hampshire and Massachusetts, they require it for lobster pots. Mm-hmm. For some of the other states, it's also fish pots. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, they all have regulations in place. None of the regulations specifically cite a single mechanism. Mm-hmm. They list numerous alternatives, like these.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Does any state, in fact, use the biodegradable plastic?
I can't speak to states that definitely use them, but yes, in some of the states, regulation is written wording that suggests that a biodegradable panel like this would be, you know, I mean, I don't understand all of the complex, mm-hmm. you know, organic chemistry wording mm-hmm. of these guys, mm-hmm. but the states do seem to allow them within their regulations.
Yes, sir.
I got a couple questions. I mean, why does it have to be so big, and why does it have to be so expensive?
Mm-hmm.
$1.50 for that piece of plastic, $3 per crab pot, mm-hmm. not knowing how long it's going to last. It's hard for me to comprehend it as being a useful tool, I tell you.
Well, I can't speak to the expense, mm-hmm. but as for the size, the smallest size that at least for the blue crab fishery, the states permit mm-hmm. are Florida and Texas, which is 3 by 6, which is actually smaller than these, I think, produce an opening that is 3 by 5 inches. And I think that is to allow fully, you know, crabs that have grown within, you know, been caught by the pot, maybe grown within the pot, to be able to.
I'll tell you, I'll bring you a picture of a 5.5-inch female crab going out of a 2 3/8-inch ring. Anytime you want to see it. You know? A lot of them go out of those rings, I can tell you that. It doesn't have to be nothing nowhere near that size.
Yes, sir. We may want to get a little bit of information from Mr. Blackwood here.
Okay, yep. All right.
Pertinent to these panels. That might help out a little bit.
So would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is Wade Blackwood. I'm the owner and founder of Mob Jack Binnacle Products. We bought licensed the technology from BIMS, who created a solution to an issue for the ghost pot that is obviously continuing work in progress. I was behind also a bill from a legislation side to put in to increase the conversation about addressing these issues. It wasn't to try and cram anything down the waterman's throat. It's to try and get the conversation that this is a real issue. And, you know, roughly we have about 500,000 bay-wide pots that are fished annually, easily. Okay. And so roughly 10% to 25%. Sometimes 100%. So it's an issue. And this is something I feel passionate about as a Virginian. I'm a fisherman. And I think that this is a solution that obviously there's some hurdles. I'm no stranger to that. I understand the cost issue. That's not to put any more burden on the watermen that's already there. It's hard enough as is, and I get that. But I think there's some conversation that could take place to ease that cost for the watermen to do something that I think we all know is an issue. And that's something that, to me, feels like a very viable solution. And, you know, to address your point about the size, you know, this is a Generation 4. You're looking at Generation 1 that was there. This is a Generation 4. It's tougher, stronger, lasts the season. It's been tested. So I think where there's been some misconception is how this product was looked at originally. When it was originally tested and the batches were fresh. I mean, this isn't intended to biodegrade.
Right.
It's not intended to sit around and be used 5 years from now. It's intended to go away. And that's what we want, you know, so the trap's lost. So if it's fished, it can last a season with the new new batches that come out. We tried to get, and obviously I understand the hurdles also from BMRC to test the panels. The intent was when originally they went to BMRC, you know, 2,500 panels went to BMRC. I didn't charge anything for that because the intent was not to test the technology. It was the implementation and be able to hand them out to people to understand what they look like, what we're asking people to do. It wasn't intended to test the technology. There are new batches that are out there that are like these that are stronger and tougher, and I think, you know, obviously addresses the issue about escaping, can be used to patch and repair. It's pretty tough. And it's right now, yes, it's $1.50, but you know, that's with small runs of what I'm doing. I'm not in this, it's not something I'm trying to make money on. I just believe and I feel passionate about, you know, this is an issue in the Bay. We have the technology in front of us to fix it. And I think that we could, if we put our heads together, we can find a credible solution.
Mm-hmm.
Can I
see that? Yeah. I still go back to, you know, why it's got to be so large. I mean, that thing is huge.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Don't realize how much it weakens a pot. When you cut that much out the side of your craft pot on each side at the upsize juncture, I mean, it is huge.
Okay.
It don't need to be half that size if you had to use it.
Well, I think it was intended to be the funnel size, the entry funnel size. So anything that size goes in comes out as well.
Yeah.
I
don't know. I don't know why everybody thinks that ghost pots are such a problem. You know, I know I've talked to several crabbers. I know from my experience, I think the 10% number is a little bit on the high side. I would say it's closer to 5% for most crabbers. Would you say that, Mark?
Yeah.
What you lose? I mean, what I lose on an annual basis. So that's half of what y'all think is being lost out there. And you know, so when you look at an average of 200,000 to 250,000 pots out there, I mean, you're drastically reducing the amount of ghost pots that are out there. I mean, what is considered a problem with ghost pots? Is it 5,000? Is it 7,000? Is it 3,000? I mean, that we have no definitive answer as to what that's going to be. I mean, that's what I have a problem with. I don't think it's a ghost pot problem. I mean, sure, you're going to lose some crab pots, but it just is not the quantity, and it's not the problem that we think it is. Don't you agree, Mark?
I agree.
Yeah. Don,
I mean, also with the galvanized pots, they go to pieces on the bottom anyway.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And how long does it take for this to go to pieces?
Anywhere from 4 to 6 months.
So how many crabs are going to go in that pot, according to you all, and die before this thing lets them out?
So we've got data from them, back by them, that says, you know, roughly, and you're looking at a harvest of $3.3 million worth of crabs that are left on the bottom of the bay and goes by.
Don't believe it. No way.
I don't believe it either. I just don't believe it.
There's plenty in there for him to eat.
I mean, look, this pot's been going on forever. And there are a lot. Potting has been going on forever.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pots way back there than there are now. And I don't see we had any problem way back there with the ghost pots. I don't know about anybody else.
I mean, you're also talking about recreational people running over lines. You can't say, look, if they're in channel markers and people are losing pots because of that.
Yeah.
There's a whole number of issues that are out there for losing pots. And I think, I have a hard time hearing, like, oh, it's not an issue.
Yeah.
But it's got to be some sort of issue if people are losing the traps. And it's being studied.
I mean,
so, I, you know, I...
It's,
I'm producing them. Taking the data that's coming in, and you know, I have a hard time thinking that
it's not right.
This isn't going to be an issue. So I'm not, and again, I'm not looking to try and tap
right.
the water.
Be honest with
I'm
you.
Looking to try and come up with a solution to an issue, and you know, I realize there may be varying degrees of what is a concern. Here.
Right.
But you can't say that it's not.
Yeah, I don't think it's as bad as what everybody says. But, you know, I know some people that were ghost potting. I'm not going to call any names. They took the same pot and threw it overboard a mile away and caught it the next day because he couldn't find enough pots on the bottom. This is the God's honest truth. He couldn't find enough pots on the bottom. It made them look bad. They're getting a check. They're not finding any pots. I mean, the guy told me I'd find it today, tear it half a mile down, throw it back overboard, and find it the next day.
They were calling it job security.
Was anybody there? I mean, here's the deal. Was anybody there when they brought those pots in to paint those pots?
You mentioned the number of pots that they say they pulled up. Was there any verification of that?
And
what was that number again for everybody? Because I'm talking
32,000 over a 4-year period.
32,000 over
a 4-year period. Right,
8,000.
Yes.
8,000
a year.
I cannot, right now, speak to the methodology that the researchers at BIMS used in this specific project. Perhaps someone.
Rom, can you speak to that at all? The ghost spots in
the. They took them to the dump. They paid them to take them to the dump.
Yeah, I mean, look,
I will tell you that. CBSAC, the technical committee, which, first of all, the study was done by a separate group at BIMS. We didn't do that study. That was done by the Center for Coastal Resources Management. CBSAC is now reviewing the report to assess how, what kind of impact it has on the blue crab population. So there are really two issues. One is the issue that, yes, ghost pots are being lost. There are derelict pots out there, and they're having somewhat of a negative effect. That by itself says, hey, can we try to avoid that problem? The second part is it a problem for the blue crab population? And we are preparing a report, which is an evaluation of the derelict trap report. And the only thing I can tell you right now, I'm not going to give you details, but basically, we don't agree with the findings of the report. We don't think that this time that it's a serious problem for the blue crab population. Again, I want to emphasize there are two issues. One is, does it inflict severe mortality on the blue crab population versus it is something that's having some kind of negative effect.
Or a positive effect, possibly, too, by
well, the only
by habitat for oysters. I can bring you pictures.
I agree with you there, but again, that's probably minimal as well compared to.
We've had a picture of them from crab pot that over a bushel of oysters in
the sure,
it's a lot of problems.
Right, but what I'm saying, so I've been involved with the oyster restoration effort, and I can tell you that the. Mm-hmm. If you take all those pots put together, they're not going to eat the total crop. Exactly. So, I guess what I would say in terms of the blue crab or the oyster is not likely going to have a really strong effect.
Right.
What I think this committee should deal with more is the other issue that it is having a negative effect in some cases,
mm-hmm.
and what can be done that's not extreme in terms of trying to eliminate or alleviate the problem. I will say one thing is the shift to vinyl coated pots, I think, is a bad thing.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And that in itself, because they're going to remain longer,
yep.
and so it's going to cause more of a problem.
Yep.
So for me, the committee should consider, can we in some way avoid having the vinyl coated traps so that we can try to at least compensate for this problem? Because I think that's going to be much more of a problem. They're going to accumulate much more, and then it might become a pretty serious problem for the population,
yeah.
for the blue crab.
Yeah.
And I saw a hand up back there. Yeah. Rob, would you entertain the comments at this point?
Sure, that's fine.
Yes, that's right.
My name's Tim Wyville. I'm a waterman. Here, let me say how many crabs are in the pots when they ghost potted. When we ghost potted, you guys showed up here where the most crabs, fish, and everything were caught in pots. The Middle Bay, eastward, there was like nothing. And over here in the Western Shore, we had a few problem spots. It ended up that was some people left their gear out that they just went down through and just basically picked up their stuff. It wasn't.
So you, Tim, you did some ghost potting.
Yep. Fished in the Middle Bay, Lower Bay, and the seaside. And they got our pictures, and I bet they're wearing enough crabs to eat all year.
Yeah.
If you leave a pot while we're fishing, and Monday morning, if it's a weak pot and they're dead crabs, we got so many leatherback and turtles and loggerheads, they just rip the whole side out of the pot. Ghost pot. Don't have much of a chance if it's...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I tell you that.
One thing that all of us know as crabbers is if you fish a pot and there's a dead crab in it and you leave that crab in it, no crabs go in that pot.
Nothing in it.
Right.
The other thing is that I have, and everybody else that does this too, I have 1, 2 pressure washers and a 32-foot barge that I clean my pots on because if I don't clean them, they don't catch well.
Right.
The more they foul, the less they catch.
Right.
If there's anything dead in there, even a claw, crabs don't go in it.
Right. And most of the time associated fouled up pots with oyster toads, to be honest with you.
You all had the pictures here showed how many were caught in different areas of the bay that were in the crab pots. Mm-hmm. Anywhere from Middle Bay eastward, there was like nothing. Mm-hmm. There was only a couple isolated spots here on the western shore. And that was it.
Give us a sense of how many days you spent it doing that? Picking up pots, old pots?
I mean, they only give us a certain amount of days.
Yeah, how many days was that? I can't.
I don't remember.
It was 2 or 3 months. First year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of stuff that we hardly ever caught a full crab pot. They were parts and pieces.
Foot by foot square, you get parts of the pot.
Yeah, piece of bar.
All right.
What was the amount of money that was spent paid to use?
It was a waste of time, I think, for everybody. But
it was grant money, yeah. And you know yourself, once a pot becomes derelict and it starts getting dirty, you know, number one, when the zinc goes, you know, the galvanized pot's going to start corroding. As it gets dirtier, it's going to catch even less crab. A crab is not going on a dirty funnel and is not going through a dirty upstairs. I can tell you that. They just ain't going to do it.
I've got a question. Do you have any kind of maps that show the problem areas by any chance?
Yes.
You do?
Yeah, there's a map geolocated for every derelict pot that was picked up. It was actually closer to 43,000.
Okay, now, were there specific areas?
It said items instead of pots.
That were,
they all weren't full pots. They were just parts and pieces and stuff.
It wasn't as pretty as that one on the front page of the Daily Press.
I guess what I'm getting at, are there specific areas of problem, is what I'm getting at. Because Tim is saying there's not a problem in certain areas. Certain areas we do have a problem.
We found pots in 2 different places.
Okay.
And they were real high travel areas.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. Kip the Peak and Cherry Stove. That was it. Anything in between, you rode for miles and miles and couldn't find pots.
Yeah, boys. Yeah. Okay.
You know why? Because they travel so hard.
Yeah. All right. We have. I'm glad to see Mr. Jenkins back in the back there. You've got something.
Yeah, you know how that grew
my man. Well, I know you've got some wisdom, so I better call on you. Don't want to miss the opportunity.
Doug Jenkins, I've been crabbing a few years, and I whispered in Rob's ear a while ago, my grandson and my son and I, we fish around 700 pots, peeler pots and crab pots. Last summer, we lost a total of 16, whole summer.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that's a problem percentage, you know, it's going to blow this out the way. But the other thing is, I think they're more beneficial than they are harmful. To begin with, a small crab will go in there. Where we crab, we have a lot of trouble with catfish.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If they go in there for protection, you know. Mm-hmm. And they shed it off, and the pot, we fish galvanized pots now. I don't fish bottom pots. But some places in the Rappahannock, a pot won't last us through the summer. So, you know, what home is it doing if it is a ghost pot? Well, we have a rig to find our pots, and we set them in rows, and we know every stump and tree along the river. And if we lose one, we can tell we missed a pot from one to the other, mark it, and go back with the drag and catch it. A pot, by the time we rig it up and put it up, it's $40. That's why we don't want to lose. Right. I don't set them around boat ramps.
And Mr. Jenkins, how often do you fish your pots? That was something else that was part of the discussion that maybe we ought to...
Well, we fish every day.
Every day.
Every day. Some days we shouldn't be out there. I know it's rough and nasty. If the thunderstorms get too rank, we go to shore.
Right.
We don't get on a tree, but we get off the water in case something did hit them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, with feeder pots, we fish crab pots. And if the feeder runs on, we take the crab pots up, put them on the bank, and concentrate on the peelers, and the peelers drop off, we put crab pots overboard. But, I mean, that's totally not possible. You know, I think it's more beneficial than it does harm. I really do. I think if you leave that pot out there, like you say, they've all feeded it, fouled up pot, crab won't go in there. So this is as far as I'm concerned, I don't, no disrespect to the gentleman invented this thing, I want to push it. But, and I'm not worried about Texas and these other states. They don't have the same terrain, they don't have the same bottom or whatever as we have. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the Rappahannock and tributaries of Potomac. I'm not talking about down the bay here. Y'all may have an issue with that. But for a statewide thing, my suggestion would be if somebody fishes a vinyl pot and them has put out some reports before that was completely false or misleading. Now, I don't know who's behind this, but it's not right. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jenkins.
And if I could just
one
comment. And Rob, I think you know also the difference between galvanized pots and vinyl pots. The reason why some people use the vinyl pots is because they don't have to put the zincs in them.
Right.
That's a tremendous cost in a galvanized pot. Three zincs a year approximately in a galvanized pot. You put one in a vinyl pot, and it pretty much lasts the life of the vinyl pot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why a lot of people go. But they have a drawback. They get dirty much quicker.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hang on one second. Rob, you're the podium.
I
want you to respond to a couple of these comments so far.
Put this in perspective.
Yeah.
And
I think it's a beginning discussion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we want to see a win-win solution. I don't think we want to do mm-hmm. something that's
I think you have to remember that, and I don't know this. I mean, I'm not at the top of the chain, obviously, but I know the past administration and this administration has concerns about derelict pots, okay? I know that much.
Right.
I also know that this administration's interest seems to be to, ameliorate or lessen that problem. Listening to people tonight, one thing's clear to me. You know, we had a buoy tagging regulation in 2001, but we could not get the money from Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of you are sort of indicating that one of the problems is no one really knows, is it 5%?
Mm-hmm.
Is it 10%? We don't really know. Well, you know, certainly buoy tagging if we ever come a day where we do that and we have the help to do it here, we would start to get a feel for this problem.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, which is really important not to forget for next time, is Mark. I think you brought to the attention pots being dumped in Lynn Haven.
Right. Yeah,
I just heard Mr. Wyvil pretty much indicate the same thing for one of the areas that was going on with the ghost pot collection, the derelict collection. So I tried to find out exactly why in 2011 the tending requirement was dropped, and it was too hard to piece together because our minutes are so abbreviated. You can't really tell what went on.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can get the recording, I will. But it's really a fallout from gill nets. There's been a gill net tending requirement for many years, and if you notice that language that Sarah showed you, it pretty much parallels that. Mm-hmm. But that's also something to think about as well. I mean, you know, how many pots would not be lost if there was a five-day tending? And I'm just saying to you, think about that
any
for the next time.
Any comments on that from
yeah,
the members here?
I've got a few comments. Mm-hmm.
On the tending?
On the tending, yes, absolutely. In Windhaven, we've had two crabbers come in there last year, and basically what they did, they put their pots out, fished them one time, and left them. And because of where I, you know, I crab up there everywhere, I've had homeowners come to me and say to me, can you move those pots? And I'm like, no, you can't. Mm-hmm. You know, I told them I can't move them. They called VMRC, and VMRC officer told them, basically, or operations told them that there's nothing that they can do about it. I also talked to an officer and said, the only thing I can do is wait for the season to go out, and then I can give them a ticket. Now, that was in July that happened. Those pots stayed out there from July until I know for a fact December 1st.
That makes sense to me. I didn't understand your comment when you told me. Now, since it was July, that makes sense.
It was July.
December is when the pots.
And the man did get a ticket. And this is hearsay, is what I was told by another individual. He did get a ticket, but the officer told him if he removed his pots by the time they went to court, he wouldn't be found guilty. He would drop it. Basically, he went out there to try to get the crab pots up. He couldn't get them up. He cut the buoys off.
They're so dirty, you can't get them out of the water.
Yeah, it's what he did. Mm-hmm. So to me, a tending requirement would probably help 100% mm-hmm. in certain areas.
Yes, it would.
We have a guy that does the same thing. He'll work his pots while it's beneficial. As soon as the dollars and cents go down a little bit, he just leaves them. Oh, but yeah. He does come back and pick up whatever's left before the end of the season. But he just... It might be 60 days he hadn't fished them.
Must have plenty of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there are several aspects to this that I hope you will consider before the next time. And certainly I'll try and figure out why it got to the commission, the pot tending, but then it didn't get finalized. Mm-hmm. Must have been other things going on as well. The last thing I want to mention is, and I know, you know, Mr. Blackwood has come here this evening and appreciate him being here to explain a little bit more on the biodegradable panels. Keep in mind that there are other materials as well, and so, you know, at this point, I'm telling you what I know, that the current administration is interested in making this less of a problem.
Right.
That's
have they been given the correct information, or are they drinking the Kool-Aid?
Right.
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how in-depth it's been, because it's a new administration.
And I'll say also, Pete, public perception is reality.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Smoke
it's
right
not
wrong.
Whether it's right or wrong. And so I think in some regard, smoke this administration is a political body just like any other administration, right. And they're going to think about public sentiment.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. JC.
Yeah, Rob, on the next CMAQ meeting, can we look at, put on the agenda, can we look at alternative panels? Escape rings, bungee cord, other than just talking about this one panel. It's a lot more options out there. This is a very expensive option.
Okay.
You've got to do something. Before I'm agreed to anything, there's got to be something cheaper.
Alternatives beyond what was discussed as alternatives today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, larger present rings, we already have two and three-eighths rings in the pot. The bungee cords, different things like that. I mean, it's a lot of options out there.
Well, you're going to be the wealth of the practice. I think we can follow up with some of the other states to see what they use alternatively.
We don't have to reinvent the wheel.
One second. This is what the other states are using alternatively.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So this is what these are taken directly from the regulations. The other states, it's obvious to me that they have written one regulation based on another regulation because literally there were no other alternatives other than these, and each state had it pretty much the exact same wording. So these are the alternatives that the other states have.
Okay.
But I'll also make sure to get the map from the VIMS researchers about the areas.
I just text Kelly Price. Now, did VIMS give people that found more ghost pots some kind of bonus or some award or something? I'm pretty sure.
No.
not to my
knowledge. Sure.
There was a flat daily fan, is what I remember.
Well, I mean, maybe not money, but just a T-shirt, a hat, because they give him something. And you may have not. He picked up a lot of pots in Greenback and all that area. I just texted him. I asked him, what did he find? He said, very few dead crabs and very few live crabs. And he made a good point. If you want to see, take a crab pot, put 20 crabs in the upstairs, leave it for 3 or 4 days, and go back and count how many is in that pot. They go out. Look, in a peeler pot, you can cut one of those little inch marshes, and it's amazing how many crabs will get out of that little. I mean, look, we put our peeler pots over in spring. We try to, you know, fix all the holes into them, but when you put them over in spring, that's when you got your biggest catch. You'll come up on that pot. That pot will have 2 or 3 crabs in it. The rest of them might have 13, 8, 9. You know it's a hole into it. And if you look, you will find it.
It doesn't have to be in the outside of the pot either.
No.
You can have one bar broken on the upstairs, and they'll go from the top to the bottom through that hole.
They'll go back down through the upstairs.
You can cross-eyed look at one.
I mean, they're amazing. I wish we did have a pot where we could catch them all and they couldn't get out. We'd make more money, but they're smarter than we are.
All right. Wayne, did you have any?
No, indeed.
All right. Ron.
I just had a comment. I'm not sure about the full extent of those, but my familiarity with the lobster fishery, they have different shapes in their escape panel, the biodegradable ones. So there are other versions of panels that are biodegradable.
Right.
Might be worthwhile looking at
those. Don't.
Let me see that.
You don't need a panel that size. I can tell you that now.
Oh, my God.
You don't need a panel, period.
No, but right. If you did, it's going to be.
All right, so. Follow-up meeting, is that where we want to finish up the night?
Yes. He was in waiting. Did you have anything else?
You want to kind of reply? I don't want to give you a shortchange, and I know you have good intentions. Well, I think
expensive topic.
Yeah, we appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah,
but we just don't think it's that big of a problem. I mean, we do it every day, and that's all. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, respectfully.
It'd be interesting to get that sanctuary for a couple of years to try it out.
This isn't the only state that I've looked at. This is a Bay-wide problem.
Better give it a place to go.
So, you know, you're talking about, you know, we control mortality rate for these crabs for the most part. And this is an industry where we have direct impact on that. And this is something that we can do to mitigate that problem. One way or the other, depending on how big the problem is, whether you think it's a very small problem into the one you think is a very big problem, it is something that we control. We control that more power.
I don't think so. I think the blue catfish, the red drum, and the striped bass control
the talent
and the
striped
bass.
Right, okay. Yeah.
It's fairly simple, but, yeah, I mean, you know, if going to galvanized processing, great. I mean, if you're going to spend more money doing that and having that disappear, then you are, you know, coming up with a solution for, you know, right now it's $1.50 in an economy of scale. I mean, we can get that down probably to $1 based on getting enough people to do it. And that's a fact.
Well,
right now it's new.
The trick for us is, if you could make this work, it would be good. Because it's a lot cheaper for me to put 2 of these in a pot and have them last the whole season than it is to put the number of zincs that I have to put in a pot. They're $2 a piece this year.
Right.
But if you don't put, you've got to have something that's going to withstand pressure washing and the use of the pot. If you can get it to do that and last 8 or 9 months, then I think you're correct. It would be a win-win.
Right.
If you can't do that, and I have to stop in the middle of the season, now putting the zinc in a pot is no problem. I can do that while I'm working the pot.
I just stick it in there and twist it around and throw it back overboard. But this pot, I've got to bring it up. I've got to cut all the rings off, and then I've got to put another panel in it. And the pots that I have, we'll use them for several years. And if I have to replace this panel every year and I can't cut the hog rings off, they're going to be hog ringed to death around this one little area. And it's going to be a labor-intensive project replacing these panels, whereas zincs aren't. That's the thing. It's labor-intensive to have to deal with that pot, and the only thing that I have that I can never replace is my time.
That's a good point. I think, I can give the new generation to anybody that wants to try. I mean, they do stand up to pressure washing. That's something we tested from day one, and I realize it goes through a lot of wear and tear. But, this product kind of evolved. You saw some of the first generation ones that were on here, even the prototypes to where we are now. And that's all based on feedback that we've got. I think we're zeroed in on, okay, size might be an issue here, but pretty darn close.
This is when you're acquiring that. This is your latest prototype here?
That's not the latest. That's a
10-4.
Well, I, for one, would be more than willing to try them. Okay. And I'll try them in more than a handful of pots. Yeah.
But it doesn't take just a couple. You don't have to do them in every pot.
No, I mean, I'll try them in a consistent number, and I'll take a photograph of them and put a date on it of every time that I have to pick it up and clean it and what it looks like when I get done with it.
But you're requiring two per pot, right? You said you could get the cost down to a dollar, but you're requiring two. That's $2 a pot.
Yeah, so,
why two?
Geometrically, if the pot falls over on the side that the skate side on.
Come on.
We got an iron on the pot. I can't have a pot slipping upside down.
And you're saying that will withstand a power washer?
Yes.
And what size power washer did you?
I mean,
I look now. We've got 4,000 pressure with a turbo nozzle that will cut your finger off. I'm trying to be serious. When we power wash pots, we do it in the fastest way we can. If you've got a 2,000, you're not going to do it as fast as you've got a 4,000. I'm being serious. I'm not trying to cut you
down. We're on a learning curve here.
Yes. I understand. When we did it was – I don't remember the exact – I've got the numbers.
I was just asking.
I mean, your power washer, like you said, can cut your finger off. It can dissolve brick on the side of my house. I mean, I get that. But
it's amazing.
And things like this, I mean, I can't really go and give you a product that's not going to have some kind of care involved in order to do what I would say is kind of the right thing on a little bit of protection for this. And this is an issue that it's small to some people, it's very large to some, but the state of Virginia it's a concern, and I've heard that. So I want to see if there's an opportunity.
Is it a concern among watermen? Or is it a concern on VIMS?
They're Virginia's crabs. They're not the watermen's crabs. They're this Commonwealth's crabs. And so I think the people that are concerned about it, I think it's big enough of an issue to take notice. I mean, we're trying to work with a solution. I think there's an opportunity to do that.
Everybody has concerns. I'm concerned over the rockfish. I think it ought to be open, right wide open, so we can get them down so the crab can survive. There's a lot of ways you can look at this.
I'm well aware of that. There's a lot of mystery in the bay.
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah.
Right. But I think this is something that, whether it's increasing bushel limits, whether it's, a couple extra days in the sanctuary, but it's something along those lines, I think, where we can get to a win-win or greater move for the industry.
Yes, but you can see that there's the margin that the watermen, particularly crabbers, I find are some of the best businessmen in the bay. And
I respect that.
Margin is important to them, as I think you can hear.
It's just not here. Grana. We're talking.
Something I think. I think education and learning from each other is a good start, and I see Rom speaking of education and learning.
Yeah. The report, and just so you're
aware, the group of us, the CDSAC, is not at all associated with the report. So it's going to be an objective evaluation of the derelict trap report if we're going to go through everything. So you may want to...
Yeah. You know, there's a simple way you can do
this. If I can just say one thing from a waterman's perspective, I mean, all we're asking is allow us to test these products. You know, what happened in Richmond this year was wrong. You did not go about it the right way. If you'd have brought it down here, we could have discussed it here. We'll get some crabbers. We'll test this panel. We'll test different alternatives to it, you know, and we'll come up with a solution. Everybody wants to make this situation better,
sure.
Regardless whether it's a huge problem or a small problem. It's just things we can do, and we're willing to do that. But we've got to have data. We've got to have science. It was no effort put into science or data collection on this product. You know,
the best way to do this is take pots in different places during the winter.
Put them over.
Put them overboard. Pull them up. Just make sure you have them. And I'm not, I'll put it like it is. Make sure there's a waterman on there, and maybe there's somebody from VIMS to look at this pot and count, see what's in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
see how long it lasts.
That's the only way you can tell.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you just got to look and see how bad this situation is.
You were talking about other states and the offshore lobster fishery and stuff, or maybe inshore too. I don't know what their fouling problems are compared to ours.
We'll take Louisiana for example.
Yeah, well,
it's pretty big.
Yeah, well, it's a real problem where I am.
And
that causes me to have to wash my pots a lot, and that's my main concern with this. Now, if I had to replace it annually over the winter or something, and I could go from galvanized pots to plastic coated pots, it would save me money.
Yeah,
no, you won't go that way.
But I really, you know, like JC said, the plastic pots foul even worse, so I'm cleaning them more. So, because it's a larger surface is basically it.
Yeah.
As the pot gets older, the surface gets rough. The galvanized isn't smooth, and they foul worse when they're older than when they're new. Just that little bit of difference. You know, am I going to be really wearing this thing out?
I don't think so. I mean, it doesn't wear it.
With the pressure washer.
Because
if it stays overboard, it's going to start to get soft, or is it just erode?
No, it the longer it stays in the water, the bacteria eats it. So the longer it's in the water.
Well, see, I can just picture me putting these things in the spring because they're required, or over the winter,
right.
And then about the time things are doing really good, I start washing my pots and I'm blowing holes in a bunch of them.
Yeah.
I'm going, God Almighty, I don't have time to do this right now.
Sure.
I mean, because I don't pick all my pots up one time and clean them. We're continually rotating through the pots.
Yeah.
And, I put 20 or 30 pots on the barge and I take off 20 or 30 and put them on a boat to set them back. Am I going to have to hire a man to sit there in the yard and put all these panels in while I'm off doing whatever else I got to do the rest of the day?
Sure. No, I understand all those issues. I mean, the delicate balance is you want them to go away after a lobster event.
Right, but I don't want them to go away in the middle of the season.
Right, I know. So the new generation is at 17% thicker, and that I think is the max that it could go from thickness wise that will last an entire season, probably some.
How come you didn't have escape rings in this one?
Only you already required to have.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't want an escape ring one because the thing would deteriorate around the edge and then you'd have a bigger ring.
Yeah.
They're 15 cents a piece.
Oh, I know, but I mean, if you're putting one of those in, why not put it all in at once?
Well, because the thing would deteriorate around the side of the hole and you'd be releasing, you know.
Well, what would you have in a peeler pot?
Hang on.
What kind of?
There isn't anything.
Right.
Everything's in the hard crab pot?
Not yet.
Maybe I should shut up, but I know there's going to be conflict there.
I've got a. Is this the color? Is this the color of the actual panel that you're producing
the
now?
The new ones are green.
They're green. Okay. I mean, you might want to pay attention to the color.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Sea turtles have a tendency to want to eat the orange ones.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Thinking it's a sponge on a crab.
Sure. Right.
And that would not last at all. Just,
well, yeah. No, I'll run out of the pipe hole.
Turtle destroyed. He'll destroy a galvanized pot.
Yeah, I mean, they'll just grab a hole.
Chew it up just like it's a piece of spaghetti. Yeah, unbelievable.
All right, so We appreciate your interest, and I think you've heard some folks that are interested and would try them, so I'd take them up on it.
Do you have any cards with you?
Last thing I would say is that maybe get the VIMS group that did the study to come up and present so that you can actually see the data and how that process unfurled.
Sounds
instead of, you know, kind of a third party. Yeah. But I think that's important piece to see kind of what I saw when I acquired.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know we appreciate
it. Cards?
So,
cards? Business cards?
So, additional items? Anything else, Rob, the members that we need to?
No. My suggestion would be I'm also a member of CBSAC. Not a very good member in the last few years with what I've been doing, but I would suggest that we wait and get the report back from CBSAC. And then it might be time to hear from the investigators. I've heard from the investigators twice, and I think it's going to be really important to hear that CBSAC report. Other than that, appreciate you being here tonight.
Thanks. I'll give you a call.
And hope that we can get some more committee members next
one
time
more
around.
Form, right?
Yeah, pretty close. The other thing is, I mean, I wouldn't suggest we meet until we have the results from the Baywide Winter Dredge Survey.
Right.
Is that acceptable?
Well, I had a question.
But let's say on this meeting date, Baywide Winter Dredge Survey is when again?
We're looking late April might be okay, would you think, Ron? Yeah.
So we'd have a meeting May 1?
Probably right around May, first week in May. As close to that release of the information as possible.
What do you all think of that? Can you think we can get more people here at that time? Fewer people? We'd like to have a quorum. I think, you know.
I know somebody, Rob, that would like to be. That's
okay.
All right.
Contact.
Daryl Hurley. Junior.
Okay. Now, what we have there is it's the commissioner. It's the commissioner that makes the recommendations, does the appointments, and we will have a new commissioner, and that will occur on March the 19th. Commissioner John Bull's last day is March the 16th, so there would be time for any recommendation to go to the new commissioner by that time before our meeting. Now, you all know he's not new. He's been here before in many different facets. So
okay.
I think the last one was 2006 through 2012 he was commissioner.
So we're kind of thinking we're good for an early May meeting, first week of May.
And we'll keep in touch.
Okay.
And we'll try and coax some of the others along.
Yeah. Do we call people and give them a little more heads up, just say, hey, remember the meeting or anything like that?
Yeah, we do
that?
It by email if that's okay.
I think we ought to call.
And that
call
was, them. That was yeah. A little problem this time, Rob. I know this wasn't posted till yesterday on your agency meeting website.
Okay.
Yep, yesterday, the first time it went on. I got an email from you a couple of weeks ago,
but
I wasn't sure we were even have a meeting.
I mean, the emails, this day and age, you can get so many emails, it's hard to keep up with them.
Yeah.
So
I will call people. Yeah, I will.
Okay. I don't know if you have to, but I'm sure there's someone that can help you, perhaps. All right, so anything else for the good of the cause? There's an audience member. Okay, you good?
Yeah.
Yes, sir, one more.
We're not having a quorum. We haven't had a quorum now for four meetings.
Four
meetings. You know, I mean, to me, look at who's attending these meetings. If they miss 10 meetings, remove them.
Right.
I mean,
well, when I call, I will ask, do they have any intention of coming to the meeting? Because, and I'll look to see how many meetings they've missed, and I'll say, look, we'd like to have a full committee. If you don't intend to come to the meetings, or if you're only going to make one out of four, it might be time that you consider doing something else.
Right.
Well,
I
see Mr. The two Wivels back there. I mean, they show up at more of these meetings.
Yeah,
than
they do. It's on Mars here. They're here.
I show up every.
Oh, and one more thing, just for the record.
All right.
Just for the record, Kelly got a hat and a T-shirt from you guys for finding so many pots.
Okay.
Them.
I didn't do that.
Oh, okay. Then we got it from somebody in your office.
So I guess we're adjourned then.
Maybe right. Somebody liked him a lot and sent him one.
Or maybe he just took it and forgot. Yeah.